gonna start talking about some Florida ranching practices, history, traditions, such as that. And if Stanlo Johns can hear me over there, I see Alan under the tent. I'll get Stanlo over here, and here comes, there he is. And Junior's late as usual. I'll rustle him up. But we're going to have a workshop here this morning talking about the history of Florida ranching. And a lot of times history is not just reciting dates that in 1251 or something like that, the first cattle were in this country or something like that. That's one kind of history. And the other kind of history is kind of stories about things that happened in the past, stories about how the cattle industry grew to be what it is today. So that's kind of a different kind of history. That's the kind of history that you'll be hearing mostly up here today, with some dates thrown in to sort of give it a time context in there, I guess you'd say. Before we get started, let me mention some of the other things that are happening all day long today. Right here on the old marble stage, after this workshop, there's going to be one on the pros and cons of cow dogs. Now, I don't know how many of you know about it, but cows in this part of the country a lot of times are worked with dogs. Now, on Sarah's ranch, I don't believe y'all use dogs, but some do, now some don't. Some like dogs and some don't. And that's what we explore in this pro-con cow dog workshop, some of the pros and cons of using them. Then from between the hours of 12 o'clock and 2 p.m., there's going to be all kinds of string band music and clogging up here for a change of pace. So if you like that thing, I say, if you like that kind of thing, come on up for that. And at 2 o'clock, we're going to have some people talking about the rodeo and how it has grown in popularity, how Florida cowboys fit into the rodeo part of the cowboy image, I guess you would say. After that, we're going to have a little talk about legendary cowmen in the state of Florida. And I'm sure Junior and Vic and Jim Bob and maybe even Stanlo might get in on that, can tell you some stories about some characters that they've known over the years. And then at 3:30, Sarah Childs is going to have a bunch of people up here and talk a little bit about the role that women have played in the ranching business. Sometimes women have done so-called men's work, and other times maybe not. I don't know. Sarah knows more about that because I guess she's a woman. Is that right? Well, that's what they tell you. I better shut up and get out of here. And then we're going to wind up the day with the history of Florida ranching. For those of you who want more, or if you don't catch it this morning, of course you're not going to be hearing me now, but if tell your friends, they'll come catch it. At 4:15, we'll have that. And over in the arena area, which is behind you, over where all the smoke is coming from, you can see now the blacksmith's got the place fumigated. No skeeters over there now, I can't promise you. We're going to start off right now, I think. There's going to be some cow working demonstrations with horses and cow dogs and whips and such. And after the cattle are all rounded up out of the brush there, we'll do some marking and branding demonstrations. And following that, at about 11:30, will be a calf scramble for all the kids. You going to be over there? You know what a calf scramble is? Well, I'll tell you what a calf scramble is. You get a bunch of calves out in the arena, and you tie a ribbon to a couple of the calves' tails. And you jump in the pen there, and whoever can get those ribbons off of those calves' tails win a little prize. You want to try it? It's great fun. But anyway, at 11:30, there'll be a calf scramble over there. Then there'll be more cow working demonstrations and marketing and branding demonstrations after that, and then a horseshoeing demonstration. We've got a very fine horseshoer over there. From between the hours of 1 and 1:30, he'll be putting a couple shoes on a horse over there, and be sure to ask him questions and watch how he does it. He's a very good workman. And then that's followed by a calf scramble, and then we have some rodeo events later on in the afternoon, bareback, bronc riding, calf roping, team calf roping, bull riding. I need a drink this morning. Maybe coffee would be good for a change. The bull throwing takes place, or the bull shooting, whichever it is. I don't know which it is. And then we follow up in the afternoon with some more cow working demonstrations and marketing and branding demonstrations. So we've got all kinds of things going on over here. Just feel free to walk around and ask questions, visit, and just poke around. Let me introduce you to everybody here, and then I'll get out of the way. Jim Bob Tinsley over here on the left, he's going to sort of moderate this thing, I think. And Jim Bob is most well known as a songwriter and a singer. And his wife, Dottie, back there, has some of his records and books. In fact, one of the books, is a classic. And you need to check that out. Look at it. It's really nice. All you got to do is turn around. There it is. And then we got Vic Blackstone right here. Vic, back in the 30s and 40s, was a very well-known rodeo rider. He came from Texas originally, Midland, Texas. And he knows He's been in this state long enough to know about ranching in Florida. So we're awful glad to have Vic from down around Maine, near Bradenton Parish, Florida, up with us. Sarah Childs here is, I told her the other day that our, I had her written in the booklet as she acts as the foreman on the Buck Island Ranch. And she says, well, I'm not sure that that's the way she wanted to be billed as foreman or not. But I'll let her explain about that if she wants to. But Sarah works as a cowhand, and sometimes she tells the boys what to do on the ranch down there that she and her husband and father-in-law run. And Stanlow Johns from Okeechobee is representing, I guess, the Seminole marketing of cattle up here this weekend. If you haven't seen, some of you don't know that cattle are now being marketed by videotape. And you shoot videotapes of herds and of individual steers, and, of course, that increases your potential buying market because everybody's got a television set. Maybe Stanley will talk a little bit about how that came about. I don't know. But I know Sarah has on her ranch a lot of citrus or some citrus groves down there. I'm hoping she'll talk a little bit about the role that the citrus business has played in helping keep Florida ranching a viable sort of alternative or something. I don't know. But I'm going to turn this over. Jim Bob Tinsley.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be back this morning, and nice to see you folks here. I fell heir to this job this morning as a result of Joe Ackerman not being able to be back today. Joe gave a little bit of information yesterday about the cattle industry in Florida. It's our oldest industry here. There was a book written in the 1930s called Four Centuries of Florida Ranching, and that's what it meant, 400 years of cattle raising in Florida. And I don't think that there's any other state can make that statement. Some of DeSoto's cattle got loose here, and whether or not any of the strain is in present cattle is a moot point. But after that, then in the 1500s and 1600s, there was a lot of Spanish ranching going on here in Florida. Joe mentioned the fact that where we're sitting right now was once a part of a large Spanish ranch here. Some of the Seminole Indians worked on some of these Spanish ranches. They built up their own herds. And I'm sure that Stanlow will be able to discuss that. He's compiled quite a history on Seminole ranching, and I'm sure he'll touch on that. Then the settlers from the Carolinas and Georgia started coming down in here in the 1830s. Some of them came right here into what is now, or what was then also, Columbia County, and settled in a little village down here just 14 miles south of us called Alligator, which is now, of course, Lake City. They pushed the Indians farther and farther south, and as they did so, they took their cattle with them. And finally, the stand was made down in South Florida against this encroachment of the herds into the Seminole lands. This occurred in the 1830s and 40s, this migration of the domestic cattle into the southern part of the state, DeSoto, Everglades, and in that area. The original cattle that we had here was the old Florida scrub cow, which weighed about 600 pounds, and I mentioned yesterday that one man referred to it in an article years ago, even before we'd ever heard of the term 4-H. He called the Florida scrub cow 4-H cattle, and that he meant hide, hoof, hair, and horns, and that's just about it, hardly any meat at all. Thomas Edison had a summer home in Fort Myers, and he was quoted one time as saying that Florida beef tasted like, or it had the texture of belting, and that it took a lot of hacking to even cut the gravy with a knife. So, but with these, that was a cross between the Spanish cattle that was here and the mealy-nosed cattle that the English or the Anglo-Saxons brought in from Georgia and the Carolinas. I think probably a good time right now. We've got George Mills, who's another member of this panel, on his way up here and carrying a cow whip. At this time, Stanlow, how about giving us synopsis of the cattle industry so far as the Seminoles are concerned, please, sir.
Good morning. Thank you. You know, I've heard a lot of history passed down in our amongst our people, as well as read quite a few things in history books that didn't really correspond to the history that I've learned through my parents. And June and I had discussed some of this earlier, and I said, yeah, I know I had mentioned to Vic's wife this morning that that I was kidding about Toby not being my uncle. I didn't know him. I said, yeah, I did know him, but I was just kidding Vic about him. He used to tell me about the cattle that they used to graze on Payne's Prairie. Him and Frank and some of the elder fellas. He said years ago when he was a kid, he could just do remember. And as Jim Bob mentioned, as a migration came further south, as I guess you call it, I forgot the word now. Anyway, the Indians kept getting pushed further south to where they are today, and why that particular area got to be Brighton Indian Reservation and Bixapa Reservation, I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows, other than probably the government probably said, well, nobody wants this piece of property. Just give it to the Indians. They don't need it. So we wound up with it. In the past, now they want it back. They see what we can do with it after they gave it to us. Quit running us around all over the state of Florida. But anyway, we did have cattle, and most of the Indians were farmers and ranchers for a while. And of course, as you know, as people migrate further south, they needed land for their farming and other activities. So the Indians kept getting pushed further south till Frank was telling me that his mama had told him that they had herds of cattle that these Indian, the families that lived here and there, all over North Florida here, and they would graze cattle back and forth like the settlers did here. And said in the past they would meet settlers here and there, and he says once in a while you'd hear a shooting, and that then you got a little bit leery of who you passed on the highways then. He said back then they had these horse and oxen and whatever that he said anytime you saw some white people, he said you'd get off of the road far enough away that you was out of gun range, just in case that, you know, somebody had an argument about something that happened maybe a little bit further or maybe something to do with the grazing of the cattle. And so that, he said, this went on for years and years. And so he said he buried his mama up there next to Yeehaw Junction, somewhere up along there, because Frank and I used to come up this, not here, but to Gainesville quite often. And he would inform me, this is where we used to live years ago when I was a kid. Said this is where my mama said we used to do this and do that. And it always amazed me, and never thought that, you know, he was telling me part of history, that I should have been really inquisitive and asked more questions, which I'm sorry now I didn't. Of course, Frank is still alive, so I guess when I get back home, I'll have to really get down and start questioning quite a few of these tales that he has told me. But as years went on, we began to lose all of the cattle. So eventually, in the 30s, well, somewhere in the 26, they've had a pretty good drought out there in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and that area. And so the government says, well, Ben's, we got all these Indians on the land that nobody wants. Let's send them a few head of these cattle here that's not going to survive in South Florida. So let's go ahead and send them about 500 or 600 head and see what they can do with them. So from that 500 or 600 head, we've got them up to, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 head of mama cows at Brighton Reservation, and about 2,800 in Big Cypress. Of course, these Herefords that were sent to South Florida, I'm sure doing the natural selection of the environment that they were in, sort of got to be a pretty good type of cattle as years as years went on down, because I'm sure that, well, they unloaded the cattle at San Carlos and two or three places that the name rings a bell where I had read where the cattle had came from. Of course, this was just a little bit before my time, so, but some of the things that I hear, and then some of these guys here says, yeah, they remember when they unloaded them off of the boxcars. They were starved to death, no water, and they had to drive them from Cornwell, which is next to 28 miles, I'm sure, the way the crow flies. And let's see, Cornwell is, well, it's Fort Bassinger. Back then it was a Fort Bassinger, but this wasn't right at Fort Bassinger. It was another community right north of there was called Cornwell, and of course it doesn't exist anymore. I think they had a train stop there. But anyway, that's where they unloaded them and drove them to Brighton. Then, as Frank would mention, while I used to work with Frank for a number of years, and then eventually I took over his job. But anyway, he would tell me, said, this is where we grazed these cattle when we first got the cattle in here. So you have to imagine there was no cross fences, or I guess they had boundary fences back then, but they had no cross fences, and they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 36,000 acres to tend these cattle. And he said they'd build a trap, so that they could trap these cattle during the day, or during the night, excuse me. And during the day, they'd tend to them. They'd let them go out and graze out, maybe spread out a little bit, and then at night they'd bring them back in. And I asked him why he'd done that. He said, well, they had some neighbors that wanted some of these cattle, so they had to keep an eye on them so they would pen them up during the night. And so I thought, well, you know, that's sort of a thing in the past, but yet I guess it was a past back then. So we so as it went on, as I mentioned, of course, these cattle, I imagine the bloodline come from that area there. Of course, we've had these cattle breeded up now to where the guys was talking about using dogs and using whips to gather cattle. We're just a little bit more modern than that. We just go open a gate, blow your horn, and the cattle come running across. We rotate them back and forth. Snapping whips, you know, I mean, that's good. I mean, he's talking about having pros and cons. I got in a session on pros and cons about whips way back 5 or 6 years ago, and using dogs. I like dogs. Don't get me wrong. I also have whips that I use, but you need them in a different area. You don't always use them if you got an open pasture that you can see all the cattle in, say, 300 acres. I don't think you need to go out there and snap your whip and just carry on. I mean, the whip is not made for that. It's made to get the cow's attention so that you know that you're coming in this direction and he needs to go whatever direction you think he ought to go to. So, and dogs, long as they follow your horse, they're good. But if they get ahead of you and then scatter your cattle, and the same way with the dogs. If you you need them for a rough wood such as this, but if you got an open pasture, I don't think you need a dog. But then we still use dogs. Don't get me wrong, we still use dogs. But in certain areas, we have to have dogs. In fact, a dog is probably worth 5 men in some areas. But the way we operate ours, we just go to a certain gate that we want these cattle to go through, and you know, we've gotten modern now. We've learned how to live like everybody else. We drive these four-wheel drive pickups, go blow your horn. Here comes these cattle. They go through, and you close the gate and say, well, I've done my day's work. And of course, you have to patch fence and all that, but we had improved a lot of lands that was underwater, which cost us, I'm not sure if you people understand, clearing property such as this here. All these trees and everything, you'd have to push out of the way because it would be in the way. Of course, in our area, we have swamp cabbage, which I understand they're running short of up here, which we have plenty of. We just take a drag line or a dozer and just push them out of the way because they're in our way mostly. And Miss Childs here, I've got to know her in years because her husband and her father-in-law came down. I don't know where they come from. They came down and got to be our neighbors and brought a bunch of elk with them when they came down, and we didn't know what these things were. I had one of the old men come by one day and said, down low, there's a bunch of, he didn't know, he said, look like deer, but he said, they're about three times as big as a deer, and they're not cows. He said, there's a pile of them in my pasture. He says, where did they come from? What are you going to do with them? I told him, I don't know. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I run out and looked at them, and these were fantastic antelopes that I saw. That's why I told him anyway. I said, those were elks, but they were real pretty. We had several that just stayed with us, real graceful animals. And so Dad and I got talking about it. He said, well, he said, you know, if you don't mind, if you just let them graze, you know, run them out of your way when they get in your way. He says, if the boys won't kill them for a year or two and see if they'd increase, we'll barbecue one day. So we kept that in mind. We kept everybody off them for years, oh, 4 or 5 years. And then for some reason or another, these elks, the machinery fascinated them, I guess, like a drag line or backhoe. They would stand there and watch it all day long. And we contracted out a canal to be built several miles from our main ditch to another area. And, of course, these were non-ending, so I think they went ahead and killed both of these deers and covered the hides up. They kept the horns, I understand. I hadn't seen them. They say it's somewhere floating around in Moorhaven. I hadn't seen them yet. So, of course, this has been 10 years ago or 12 years ago. But anyway, as we gotten a little bit more modern, we found out that, you know, you don't raise what you want. You want to raise something somebody else wants. So this got to be a problem with a bunch of Indians that, you know, that didn't really understand English, and you had to explain to them what they want, because they're used to doing one thing, and this is what they want to do. They said, man, I don't want to put no Brahma bulls with my Hereford cattle here. So, man, I got some pretty cattle here. I don't want no Brahma cattle in my herd. So that was another problem we had, was that we were going too straight of Hereford when I first went to work out there about 20 years ago. We were going too straight of a Hereford. So we messed around there and had a couple of other bulls that snuck in on our place and bred up some of the cattle. If you don't know what you're talking about, it's hard to try to demonstrate to someone that doesn't visualize a straight breed, and then when you cross it up, you have a little better breed, I think. But then again, you know, like I said, it's, you don't have no best of anything. You just do what you got where you're at. So we started breeding these cattle up, and then plus we had to explain to these people that, hey, you know, if you put a little Brahma blood into these Hereford cattle, you're going to get a bigger, meatier type, a beefier type animal. So we done this for a number of years, and then some of these guys were still dissatisfied. They said they just didn't like a Brahma at all because they're just too mean to work, and they try to catch you every time you get out in the cow pens with them or in the pasture with them. And so we bred enough cattle that we could see where the change come in. So from that, we started working with University of Florida. We wanted them to try to produce a bull for us that would suit us and suit the feedlot guys, because this was the type of animal that we were looking for, that we could produce down here to send out west, that they could feed out. And so from it, the way I've seen how things change was that when we'd go to sell these steers, we'd have to cut them in three different classes. You'd take a Brahma group, put them in one pen, you take the crossbred and put them in another pen, and then you take a straight Hereford and put them in a different pen. And then you would call these buyers, and they'd come in, we'd just auction them off right there at the place. So that worked pretty good. But then we got to looking at, hey, look here, these crossbreds, they bring in 5 to 10 cents more than the Brammers, so why don't we go to this type of breed and see what we can do? So this is when University of Florida came in. And so we had run a sort of an experiment station of this type of breed. Well, of course, it wasn't really one type of breed, because we had four different types of breeds. So we started breeding these cattle, and then we'd crisscross them back and forth. But in the same token, we kept this Hereford breed, straight Hereford, at all times. We of course, we'd take a Hereford and we'd breed it to a Beefmaster and so on. But we kept one herd that was straight Hereford. And we still have a straight Hereford bred of cattle at home. They said that was what made us, and we're going to stay with it as long as we can. And, of course, like I mentioned, you can keep whatever you want, but if nobody wants it, it's not worth anything. And we found out years ago, you know, if you keep something long enough, and if it may not be worth anything, they'll call it antique and sell it to somebody anyhow. So, but the cattle that we have, We don't call them antiques. They've done us a world of good. As I mentioned, and we used to call buyers to come in and buy these cattle from us, which worked pretty good. But as you know, if you was a feedlot buyer and you needed 20,000 head of cattle, you can't find them all in one pasture. You have to, in fact, you'd probably have to take 3 or 4 weeks off to look at that many cattle, and then you may not buy them. So we decided to videotape these cattle as many as we could. 3 years ago, we sold somewhere a little over 18,000 head in 6 hours. Of course, this wasn't all ours. We had them consigned with other people that that consigned them to us to sell. So we decided that by doing this, if you know what you're buying, you can see it on a screen, and you know you can see the quality of calf. You can say, well, what type of breed it is, all this. And you can stay home in your air-conditioned lounge or wherever and bid on these cattle and do good. And you can probably buy all you want just that one day. And then you won't have to spend 3 or 4 weeks down here in Florida chasing cattle or looking at cattle, because when we went out to film these cattle, we had to chase some. And then some we just, you know, you just drive out in the pasture. Some of these ranchers would say, well, I don't know, boys. He said, as soon as they see your truck, they're going to run through the woods. So I told him, just watch us. I said, if you stay here and tend to the gate, we'll ride out there and take pictures. And you can go out there and I guess maybe a strange vehicle, they get curious and they come up to you and they'll even lick your hand if you hold your hand out there long enough. But anyway, we'd get them gentled down to where we can take pictures of them. And this went on for the past 2 or 3 years. So for the past 3 years, we've been doing this. And we've done, I think, we've done real good. We've topped the market for the past 3 years, as far as I'm concerned, because no one else has been able to do it. And I'm not saying that's the best way to go. You go wherever you think you ought to go, because we had a lot of people that was consigned, that we had consigned owner our video sale that dropped out, and then some now is calling us and want to put them back on. So we may have another one in June. I'm not sure, but we're still working on it. But we, as I mentioned, at least if you don't sell your cattle, I mean, you know, you have a choice. You can sit there and say, when a man gives you whatever the top price is, or if you don't think so, you can say no sale, and that's it. Your cattle are still home. You don't have them in a pen. It's not like, you know, having run through the livestock market. You know, you sit there and watch them and say, man, that joker ought to have brought 5 cents more. But, you know, you can't, if that's all he'll bring, that's all he's going to bring. And you say no sale, and they charge you $5 or $6 for no sale fee, and then you take him home, or... And then he's done lost 40, 50 pounds. You carrying him up there and joshing him around and all that. So this way we think that if you don't no sell him, at least the cattle are still in your, at your house. And at least there's 500 or 600 people got to see your cattle. So we think that we're doing a tremendous job marketing by showing these cattle to several different people. We've had people come down here. Well, in the past, whoever buys our cattle, we don't care who buys them. We sell it to them. 6-7 months later, we follow them up. We'll go up there where they bought them and check them out, see if the man has really got what he bought. And then we ask him questions like, what can we do down here so that maybe we'll worm and fluke, we blackleg and do all this, but could he have a healthier animal back down here? What could we do down here that'll help him out that he won't have to do when they get him up to where he's got to go? So we do follow our cattle to wherever they go. Last year we tagged the cattle, although they wasn't our cattle, but yet the man had bought them was really willing to work with us, and we tagged every one of them, and then we wanted to follow them all the way to the butcher, to the slaughter, see how they graded out and everything. So we get all this information also. So we've been real fortunate to have University of Florida working with us through this. And of course, we didn't do all this by ourselves. We had a lot of people thinking for us and kind of guide us a little bit. And if we didn't think that was the right direction, well, we'd let them know that wasn't the way we wanted to go. But, you know, as Vic mentioned, we got a tent up there, and I was asked, you know, if we'd bring in one of our tapes or one of the sale tapes we had. I didn't bring the sale tapes. We usually keep those because, well, we've got 2 or 3 up there that shows how it works and how we operate. So any of you want to browse through? In fact, we got some old pictures up there that Clarence is up there also with with the Agriculture Department, and I told him that we'll kind of keep an eye on it, and if he'll keep an eye on ours. And I told him all you have to do is push a button, rewind, and set it again. But we've been up there for a couple of days, and we've enjoyed being down here, or up here, I'm sorry. Enjoyed being up here, and I don't know whether I like this part of the woods better than I like my part of the woods at home. It's kind of harder to say. Of course, I guess if I owned this place at one time, somebody took it away from it, I'm sure I'd be mad about it.
Thank you so much,
Sandlo. Be sure and go up there and see this display up with the striped tent right up there. That would remind me of, you know Baxter Black, don't you? Know the veteran, the veterinarian humorist from Colorado? He wrote a book about the modern cowboy, and the name of it is Man's Best Friend. Is about the cowboy and his dog. Man's Best Friend are...
Then I am not that historic to Florida. I've only been here since 71 and only been in ranching since 76. So even in that short amount of time, I've seen a vast change in the... I guess you'd say the role of women in agriculture, although they've been involved in it for many, many years. I believe that women are becoming more prominent in the decision-making. My last statement in our workshop yesterday was, though, that no matter how many things we decide to do or what we decide to do in the long run, when it comes down to the final decision as to what's going to be done or who's going to do it, the man around the house or the ranch is the one that will always make that decision. As far as I'm concerned, anyway, that's the way it's going to be. They make us think that we make decisions, but they're only being nice. I myself am very involved in agriculture. I work on the family ranch. I was going to say 5 days a week, but I don't. I work 7 days a week, and we don't have a five-day week. And it's a very active life, and I hope that in another, gee, I'm going to give my age away, in another 20 years or 25 or 30, when I have grandchildren, that I can sit back and tell them stories, and I have enjoyed this particular festival because I have talked with some of the older people and have learned so much from them, and it's things that I want to tell my children, because as I mentioned yesterday, one of the things that I feel, I myself personally, about the ranch that we are on is a feeling that I love to go away and do things like this, but when I cross that bridge and go home, there's been many, many times that there'll be a little tear that just kind of just automatically hits the corner of the eye, or something right here that just makes you kind of swell. I guess maybe I'm old-fashioned or something, but that's just the way I feel, and I want to be able to tell my kids stories about things, so I listen to the older people that tell these stories, and consequently I listen to the ladies, the cowbells, who are older, that I associate with quite a bit, and already when I go home from events like this, it's actually a storytelling time when we get home, and I tell them things that happened, and basically that's what we women in agriculture in Florida are doing today is learning everything that the men have been doing for years and years and years, and trying to improve and help them, and hopefully it will make our industry successful enough that we will continue on, because as I drive from one end of the state to the other, which I have noticed just in the short time that I've been here, it's just turning into a mass of concrete, which just tears me up, and it's going to get worse, I'm afraid, instead of better. So our family ranch, as others have, will become more valuable as far as sentiment goes, and also the industry to the individual family, and it's something that we ourselves are going to really have to take care of and should value and cherish tremendously.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. One thing that Sarah mentioned yesterday, but maybe some of you people weren't here yesterday, is the fact that the woman's role in national organizations, Joanne Smith from Marion County down here. Dottie and I were fortunate enough to be at the National Cattlemen's Convention in New Orleans in January, where Joanne Smith was elected president-elect of the National Cattlemen's Association. In January, she goes in Phoenix as the first woman ever to be elected to the presidency of the National Cattlemen's Association, and I would say it's a history-making thing because I know of no other thing, organization, a national men's organization that has a lady elect president. So they're coming up in this world, and it's people like Sarah and Joanne and some of the others that are making this a fabulous profession, even though it has been all along. Yesterday we said a lot of things probably about Florida scrub cattle. We said a lot of not said a lot about them, but the words were mentioned here, Bryngus and Brayford and all of these different mixed cattle here in Florida. And maybe some of the people out here don't know what a Bryngus and Brayford and some of these others are. Vic, do you and George want to say a little bit about that and clarify some of it for some of them?
Well, I'll bring that up a little. I'd like to start, though, from when I first come here and getting back to the scrub cattle. Now, Jim Bob said that they weighed 600 and 700 pounds. But when I come down here, if a cow weighed 500 pounds, she was a big cow, and she had to be dry to do that. And all these ranchers, all of them had cattle, and they didn't own no land. They all run them out together, and they only got about anywhere from 35% to 50% calf crop. They would never sell a heifer calf. They kept all their heifer calves. So and half of those would be steer calves, and if they got a 50% calf crop, they would only have 25% of them calves to sell, which wasn't very much. But they didn't need much money because it didn't cost them anything to run those cattle. And when they'd go to and put them in the, when they'd brand them and cut the bull calves, every good-looking bull calf, if he was a strong type calf, they would keep him for a bull. That's where they got their replacements. And now several of them had bremers. But like Santo mentioned a while ago, those bremers were new, and they were kind of mean. And a lot of those people didn't want to put bremers in their herd because they afraid their cattle would get so wild they couldn't handle them. So anyhow, that was in 1932 when I first come down here, and that's the way it was. I want to add a little bit to what Santo said. The Indian Reservation had the first purebred commercial herd in Florida. And I think they were probably the most successful commercial people they were, because they had to look after them a little better. And they'd done a little improving and whatnot. And about 10 years after that, that's when everybody started improving their grass and started getting better bulls and breeding up the herds. So, and then they would anybody would get to breed them up the way they wanted, the way they thought was good. But any kind of a Bremer onto a Hereford, or an Angus onto a Bremer, or any way that you cross them, the first cross was good, and the third cross was still better. As far as what Santo was telling you a while ago about having something to sell, the third cross, the cattle would get bigger and put on more weight, and that's what it's all about. But I still think that the Indian Reservation is history in helping bring this all about. That's about all I got to say, Jim Bob.
Okay, thank you very much, Vic. I wasn't around, of course, but I have read that the old settlers in the 1800s around Civil War and so forth, that one of the reasons that their cattle they couldn't improve those scrub cows was the fact that the best bulls were shipped to Cuba for bullfighting, and they got all of them and paid them off in Spanish coins, gold coins. So a lot of the best bulls were sent for that purpose. Okay, George, how about it, partner?
Well, I don't have a great lot in store this morning, but anyhow, I'm going to add something to what Vic was saying about the size and the weight of these scrub cattle. This herd of cattle that we drove from Hardy County over to St. Lucie County back in the late 30s, maybe the first year or two of the 40s, there was 325 head of the grown cattle, and you can take this... as to the weight and the size of these cattle, we changed the mark and brand on these cattle by hand, caught them and threw them and changed the mark and brand by hand. Started that morning on a Saturday morning about 8 o'clock, and we was through changing the mark and brand on them by 4:30 that evening. So this day and time, it would take you that long to do 300 head of these crossbred calves at the very best, even with good help and good weather to go with it. But I can very well remember when the scrub cattle would just feed out in the river bottoms and wherever they could get hyacinths to eat or whatever it was. And back then, a man thought he really had a bunch of cattle if he had 200-300 head of cows, and the average cows weighed 450 to 600 pounds. He had a good herd of cattle. But anyhow, as times went on, the cow breed is changed according to the way the farming has. And the cattleman had to keep up with the pace because he had to produce something that would pay him in returns for his tax and his improving expense and so forth and so on. So that's one of the reasons why that we've come to have the good crossbred type cattle that we have today, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, George. According to our schedule, we have about about three more minutes. Is anyone in the...
I'd like to mention something.
Okay,
George, Vic. This Florida country, the reason that these cattle were so little, there's no mineral in the ground, whatever. And back then, they didn't know what kind of supplement to give them, like salt. They'd give them salt, but salt wasn't enough. They needed some other minerals that they weren't getting. And after the University of Florida got to working with the cattlemen and helping them, then they've come up with a mineral with cobalt and some things in it that cows need that they don't get out of the land here. And that's one reason why they were so little.
Thank you. Thank you, Vic. About 2 minutes. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask? Yes, sir. Oh, citrus and cattle going together. I think that's one of Vic's favorite subjects.
When I first come here, the richer cattlemen now, the ones that had money, they all had a grove. And when they didn't get nothing for their oranges, their cattle would do pretty good. And when they didn't get nothing for their cattle, the oranges would do good. And they all said it would was a good thing to have the two of them. But it had to be a pretty, you know, then you had to grub all these fields out with a grubbing hoe. And it was hard to get these cowboys to do that. So a lot these rich men was the only one that could hire this done and have a grove. But it is a good combination.
The Kings down in DeSoto County back at the turn of the century, they had citrus and cattle, and they left Bone Mazel. I won't tell one Bone story. Left Bone Mazel there to help clear up some land there for a grove. And Buck King went to town and went back about 6 hours later, and Bone was lying there under one of the shade trees, sleep. And he woke him up, and he asked him if he had done that grubbing. He said, no. He says, I've decided I'm not much of an agriculturist. We thank you people for coming, and we'll see you a little bit later on at one of the workshops. Thank you so much.